needed to understand Milton and everybody else. Yes?
Can we just assure everyone we can make more copies so everyone will get
you don't get a copy. Well, at the end, everybody who doesn't have a copy raise his or her hand. We'll take a number down and we'll get it to you. And until tomorrow when the copies are available, I guess we can have them available tomorrow. But you'll have to try to share. Okay? Anyway, people may find this a little rough going if English isn't your first language. But try it anyway. This is the best, most concise statement I've run across about the principles of hierarchy as they were understood in the world up until about 200 years ago. So, and the reason we're talking about this course is about fundamental, foundational principles of Varnashram Dharma, and one of those foundational principles which we modern people have a very hard time grasping, dealing with, and accepting is the principle of hierarchy, especially as a universal principle of nature. So I wanted to discuss about that principle, especially just outside the context of Krishna consciousness. Also, there's an excerpt from two pages from Shakespeare. I'll bring it passed out. Yeah.
Whoever doesn't have a stapled version.
Whoever doesn't have a version all stapled together has the one in separate sheets. There's another sheet that didn't get included on Confucius. It's a quotation from about Confucius. You should also have a couple of pages from a Shakespeare play. Also about hierarchy from the voice and the mouth of the bard himself. We should have a one-page little summary of a part of Confucius' philosophy called the rectification of names. We should have, it's a two-page letter. Some of these have it on both sides, you know, it's one sheet with two pages. A letter from Prabhupada to Sri Govinda, a devotee. Then there's a chart. This is mostly a cue just for reference. Oh, that's interesting. I didn't get the original back of this one. This is really far out. Then there is a chart on giving the, which is a compilation from different sources of the various characteristics of the three modes of nature. I bet it's all messed up, huh? Okay. And then another compilation from three different sources of the characteristic signs of the four varnas. That's what we've got handed out, I hope. Well, I guess you should try to start reading this Milton thing here. You may find it a little hard. Some of it pertains just to Paradise Lost, which won't be of so much relevance. But I understand that the term Varnashram Dharma has been banned in Europe, so I'm sorry about this course if it causes any trouble to the to our movement. However, it is a very important part of our philosophy, and I gave as a title this the doubts that people have about the system. More than doubts, it's very serious misgivings, which I listed as a form of question. Varnashram Dharma, elitist, sexist, fascist, whatever, some, a whole bunch of other things. Sexist, elitist, fascist, racist, whatever ist, other ist has been accused of. And I wanted to deal with these problems that we have in understanding this Varnashram Dharma. Because we have to overcome certain obstacles in understanding this. It is basically based on the principle of hierarchy. What we have what we have in this is our own modern way of looking at things, and although maybe we think we've escaped some of those modern ways of looking things by becoming devotees, when you come start to deal with Varnashram Dharma, you usually discover you haven't. And the second difficulty, and I'm just talking, this is a difficulty outside people have. This is also difficulties devotees have. And the other difficulty is our experience. I mean to say, our meaning, well, our own experience in ISKCON, that's a big problem. Our historical experience in the West and people's experience in India. And the experience is of principles of hierarchy or Varnashram Dharma, which are only fragmental or partial and therefore result in abuse of power. And because of our experience of abuse of power, because in a hierarchical situation there's higher and lower, superior, inferior, and so on, with power relations structured throughout the whole system, we are afraid of those things because we see how much power gets abused, and God help those wives who have to surrender to their husbands, servants who have to surrender to their masters, and go on down the line. And so we feel that we've had quite enough of that and don't want to see it anymore. Prabhupada's way of talking about Varnashram Dharma is characteristically quite blunt. I remember at one point when Prabhupada was in Detroit, and he was talking to a group of priests. And he was trying to explain to these priests what his mission was. And he said his mission was to create a society of first-class men. And Prabhupada went on to explain, very patiently, that society normally should consist of first-class men, second-class men, third-class men, and fourth-class men. And that, unfortunately, in today's society, there are no first-class men. And so his mission was to create a society of first-class men. So after Prabhupada described what the brahmanas are, first-class men, one devotee said to the priest, "Well, what do you think?" And there was a kind of a silence. And then the priest said, "Well, we would say that was elitist." So this discussion that Prabhupada has many times, you can see first-class men, second-class men, third-class men, fourth-class men. We're very, you know, we don't want to label anybody fourth-class or even second-class. And yet Prabhupada talks that way quite clearly. Here's some other places I can show you where Prabhupada talks in an interesting way. For example, this is just from a room conversation. This typical way Prabhupada is talking. He says, "The superior, he will dictate. And yea, equal," yea means, he's quoting some Bengali statement somewhere, "and equal, they will live like friends. And those who are junior, they should follow and obey. Schoenecker was just complaining about this conception. This is the Vaishnava Niyama. Notice that he's not even talking Varnashram Dharma. He's saying Vaishnava Niyama. Niyama means rules and regulations. This is the Vaishnava Niyama. So those who are neither equal nor higher, how they can dictate, that is their mistake. Either, first of all, become higher than him, then you dictate, or you be equal with him, then you suggest. You are lower, and you want to dictate? What is this nonsense? By standard, one who's lower, they want to dictate. That's just the typical. There's many other places you could find Prabhupada talking like that. And how are we supposed to understand this? These kinds of things? Because I think that most of us in our experience in ISKCON have had quotations like this used against us, sometimes quite, we feel, unjustly. Or again, let me find another place. In the chapter 11 of the seventh canto, The Perfect Society for Social Classes, there's a description of the four varnas and also those who are outside the varnas. But there's five verses that are particularly dedicated to describing Stri Dharma, the duties of sadvi, as feminine of sadhu. Female sadhu is sadvi, which Prabhupada translates as chaste, the duties of a chaste woman. Well, let me just read these to you, and we can understand how quaintly they strike the modern ear. And again, these are the kind of statements that sometimes women in our movement have sometimes often found used to justify quite bad behavior. But anyway, here it is. To render service to the husband, to be always favorably disposed toward the husband, to be equally well disposed toward husband's relatives and friends, and to follow the vows of the husband, these are the four principles to be followed by women described as chaste. A chaste woman must dress nicely and decorate herself with golden ornaments for the pleasure of her husband. Always wearing clean and attractive garments, she should sweep and clean the household with water and other liquids so that the entire house is always pure and clean. She should collect the household paraphernalia and keep the house always aromatic with incense and flowers, and must be ready to execute the desires of her husband. Being modest and truthful, controlling her senses, and speaking in sweet words, a chaste woman should engage in the service of her husband with love, according to time and circumstances. A chaste woman should not be greedy, but satisfied in all circumstances. She must be very expert in handling household affairs and should be fully conversant with religious principles. She should speak pleasingly and truthfully and should be very careful and always clean and pure. Thus a chaste woman should engage with affection in the service of a husband who is not fallen. The woman who engages in the service of her husband, following strictly in the footsteps of the goddess of fortune, surely returns home back to Godhead with her devotee husband and lives very happily in the Vaikuntha planets. So there's a description that's there in the scriptures. And so we find many of these cases like this, first class man, second class man, third class man, fourth class man, we find these principles of a hierarchical nature, what the brahmanas are supposed to be, the shudras, vaishyas, and so on. The whole social system is articulated, which looks first of all, extremely archaic, and second of all, full of all kinds of social injustice. Now, we might think that this is extremely outdated. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati remarked somewhere and that disciples often have a tendency to find their spiritual master old-fashioned and want to bring him up to date to the modern conception of things. So we sometimes feel, maybe we should just, you know, let's just fix this up. And the modern take on these kinds of statements, well, you know, this is these statements are the product of a certain historical and cultural time and place, and this is the way people in those days believed. It was, that nastiest of societies, a patriarchal society, of which, by the way, hierarchy is supposed to be a male idea. I don't know what the hens do about their pecking order in the yard, whether that's imposed upon them by roosters or not. The hierarchy is said to be a male idea. But anyway, the idea is, of course, that social societies and social structures are human productions, made by human beings in response to their environment and their physical needs and their traditions. And they're always changing, relative to time, place, and circumstance. And this is the way people would see these statements in Srimad Bhagavatam. We're defending them, or at least we're supposed to accept them as dharma, as duty and as religious principles. And yet the modern world, actually their reaction to much of this stuff, like the Sri Dharma, first class man, second class man, and so forth, that this is immoral. Actually, they'll say it's a dharma. It's oppression, it's exploitation, and so on. So this puts us in our particular position, that what Prabhupada has taught us is dharma is viewed by the whole world, practically speaking, as a dharma, at least for the last couple of hundred years. This has been the way it's been going. But the first thing I think we should recognize, at least those of us who have accepted the authority of Srila Prabhupada, we've all have the idea that Srila Prabhupada was a liberated soul. And as such, what the liberated soul speak is in fact means it is not conditioned by social, cultural, and historical forces. It is the absolute truth. Relative truth means it comes as a product of material nature and as a product of the modes of material nature. But the statements of Bhagavatam, for example, and Bhagavad Gita are supposed to be different. There are statements of Krishna or statements of liberated souls. They do not. So that this social system, at least this is what Prabhupada is telling us, and Krishna is telling us, this social system, Varnashram Dharma, is not a human concoction. Whose concoction is it? Well, it's God's concoction. Chatur Varnam Mayastrisham Guna Karma Vibhagasaha. That's what Krishna says. He says, I made it, this system of four varnas. He said, I created it. Just as, you know, the beavers have their little characteristic way of life. They dam up, they chew down trees and dam up the streams. You have beavers in this country? And this is kind of, they dam up the streams and make their little lodges. And the squirrels have their means of livelihood and so on, their thing that they do. And it so seems to be kind of hardwired into their system. We say it's instinct or it's in their genes or somehow or other they know how to do this. Well, for human society, this is also dharma. It's as much established what human beings should do as it is for how bees should live, or ants should live, or beavers should live, or and so on. It's created by Krishna. The only difference is because human life is more conscious, it's not hardwired into the system. My computer go off here. There we go. I'll read you another statement here. This is from the fourth canto, verse 8, chapter 18, text 5. This is the earth speaking to Prithu Maharaj. The earth says, "A foolish person who manufactures his own ways and means through mental speculation and does not recognize the authority of the sages who lay down unimpeachable directions." Unimpeachable means you can't find any fault with them. They're faultless directions. Unimpeachable directions is simply unsuccessful again and again in his attempts. I'll read it again. A foolish person who manufactures his own ways and means through mental speculation and does not recognize the authority of the sages who lay down unimpeachable directions is simply unsuccessful again and again in his attempts. And Prabhupada begins his purport by saying, at the present moment, it has become fashionable to disobey the unimpeachable directions given by the acharyas and liberated souls of the past. And so on. It goes on. Complaining about our modern world and way of doing things. So, this is what we are faced with. We are faced with this teachings that are handed down, and we're also told that they are not, in fact, productions of human invention, that they are given by God. And it's really, we don't have the option to say, well, you know, the human race has outgrown that, so we'll ditch that and we'll go on and do this and we'll make this, you know, make this society this way or that way or and so on. We'll have a society where men marry men or women marry women or whatever we feel like coming up with. That's not really, according to this, our option. Based on this idea, and the fact is, you see, that there is a notion that these things, Krishna says, I created, what is a Brahmana? What is a Kshatriya? What is a Vaishya? What is a Shudra? These are set down by Krishna. So this is a very old idea, actually, that there are essences. Also, I've seen this used as a term of abuse, essentialist. He's an essentialist. Again, it's a tendency of modern thinking to say there are no essences. You know, this is an existentialist idea. There are no essences. There are no natures out there in reality. It's all something that we make up by our own use of language, how we decide what categories are. And so these terms, like what is masculine or what is feminine, these are all supposed to be socially or culturally defined things, and there are no real essences out there so that we can make ourselves over any way we like within the limit of social or even surgical ingenuity. But this philosophy that Prabhupada gives us is based on this notion that there are actual, out there, eternally existing, real essences. The word, in fact, no essence. In fact, that's one way you can translate the word dharma. Because Prabhupada, dharma means that by which a thing is what it is. Its essential defining characteristic, that's dharma. And so this dharma, There's Sanatana Dharma, which is universal, implied to all souls everywhere. And then those souls, according to their psychophysical conditioning, there's also Varnashram Dharma. And it's set out by Krishna. So this is this notion here, is there are real essences. Now, this notion is not really, as I said, limited to the Vedic culture, or what we call Vedic culture. And if you look at, those of you who have this page of Confucius, the rectification of names, this is fairly easy to understand. I've taken this from a Chinese philosopher, Fung Yu Lan, A Short History of Chinese Philosophy. So Confucius's dates are supposed to be Kung Fu Tse, I think in Chinese, Kung Fu Tse, 1551 to 1479 BC, so a long time ago. So here's what he said. Now, this is the author, Fung Yu Lan, talking about Confucius's philosophy. He says, in regard to society, he, that is Confucius, held that in order to have a well-ordered one, the most important thing is to carry out what he calls the rectification of names. Rectification, correction. That is, so this is what this mysterious term means, rectification of names. That is, things in actual fact should be made to accord with the implications attached to them by names. Once a disciple asked him what he would do first if he were to rule a state, whereupon Confucius said, the one thing needed first is the rectification of names. On another occasion, one of the dukes of the time asked Confucius the right principle of government, to which he, Confucius, answered, let the ruler be ruler, the minister, minister, the father, father, and the son, son. Still inscrutable, but now he explains what this means. In other words, every name contains certain implications which constitute the essence of that class of things to which this name applies. Such things, therefore, should agree with his ideal essence. The essence of a ruler is what the ruler ideally ought to be, or what in Chinese is called the way of a ruler, the Dao of a ruler. If a ruler acts according to this way of the ruler, he is then truly a ruler in fact, as well as in name. There is an agreement between the name and the actuality. But if he does not, he is no ruler, even though he may popularly be regarded as such. Every ruler in the social relationships implies, every name in the social relationships implies certain responsibilities and duties. Ruler, minister, father, and son are all names of such social relationships, and the individuals bearing these names must fulfill their responsibilities and duties accordingly. Such is the implication of Confucius's theory of the rectification of names. So that sounds very much like what we're talking about with Varnashram Dharma. Every name, king, minister, say brahmana, father, wife, son, there corresponds to them a dharma, and that dharma is implied by that particular name. And therefore, if society is to function properly, each person has to act according to that dharma. It's like a platonic ideal, an ideal form that exists independently of the world. And is every time creation takes place, those ideal forms become the blueprints for everything. This is also Platonic philosophy. So we have the same idea there. What corresponds to Platonic forms are the Vedas. The Vedas are there, full of the information of how to make a universe. Lord Brahma has enlightened by the Vedas, and then on that basis, he makes those things become affected in matter. But before there's any universe, the Vedas are there. They're eternal, apurusheya, and they contain all the instructions for everything. So here you see it right there in Confucius, maybe far distant from Indian civilization, or maybe not so far, I don't know. But there's the idea. If those pages from Milton open up with a quotation, C.S. Lewis opens up with a quotation from Christopher Dawson, a very famous medieval historian. He says, quoting Dawson, "The same conception of a universal order is also of fundamental importance in the religious development of India and Persia. It appears in the Rig Veda under the name of Ripta. It is usually translated as order or right, but it is difficult to find any equivalent for it in modern English, since it is at once cosmic, ritual, and moral." And again, that's a basic description of some of the fundamental principle of Varnashram Dharma. So Dawson, who's talking about medieval European ideas, he sees it in the Rig Veda. And we can also see it here in Confucius. And when Lewis discusses the conception of hierarchy, he takes a lot of the ideas from Aristotle's Politics. So it goes back to Greek philosophy, too. So it's a very common notion, this notion of essences and a universal order of such essences. As I said, that's been wiped out as Lewis says, since the revolutionary period, I guess since the time of the Aufklärung, the Enlightenment, that these things have gone by the wayside and are now considered to be retrograde. Now, just as far as trying to explain a little bit about where these ideas... Well, maybe I should stop now and just see if there are any questions so far about any of this material that anyone has yet. We'll have questions at the end, but if I'm going too fast or if I'm throwing out too much stuff, I know that not everybody, most people, English isn't their first language, and I just want to make sure I'm getting across to people.
Being involved a little bit in academia for a few months, I've noticed that actually this is a very, you might say, hot topic that is being discussed very much in hierarchy. And what impresses me is that this actually exposes a kind of nervousness in people on the academician's part about something
that's true,
not necessarily to be gotten away with, but somehow to be dealt with.
That's true. There is nervousness about the concept of hierarchy. One thing is, biologists are having a very hard time because the theory of evolution has this idea of going from lower to higher. So the question comes out, how do you establish what is lower or higher as an objective criterion? And people are trying to say now that somehow actually we have to have an idea of evolution without any idea of progress from lower to higher put in there. So there's a big debate going on in biologists. I ran across a website or something where this was being thrashed out, how to define whether complexity is a good enough term to define lower and higher. Also, if you read Prabhupada's letter to Sri Govinda, Prabhupada talks about the some of the bases of the principles of hierarchy here. I won't go through the whole letter now. But Sri Govinda, who was the temple president of the Chicago temple, was worrying about the fact that there was big competition going on among the temples to see who could distribute the most books. So Prabhupada begins this letter. He says, yes, there must always be competition. As he says, always. That gives life. That cannot be separated from life. And then he says, Sanatan Dharma means that the strong will utilize the energy of the weak must serve the strong, that we see everywhere. Is that not so? Prabhupada said. And you think, wow, what a reactionary, totalitarian sort of, you know, right-wing philosophy this is. And now, and for your assignment, I want you to read the rest of this letter and see how Prabhupada goes off and ends up in a very different direction from any political thinker I've ever seen that started this way, with this premise. See what Prabhupada does. But it is a fact that we see everywhere they're stronger and they're weak, and the weak utilize, the strong utilize the energy of the weak. And from that you get basis of a principle of hierarchy. How are you going to get rid of it? Yeah. That's always been a problem. Every time there's weak and the strong and they get established, then there's exploitation, there's injustice, there's resentment, there's envy. Our whole experience in the West has been that every time this happens, it ends up presenting so many difficulties. We can understand, you know, the Marxist and socialist idea that every time you have class or a hierarchical social structure, you have exploitation, you have oppression, and the system is. But what Marx is trying to do, of course, is somehow or other get ourselves to a position where there is no more a hierarchical structure like that. That was basically the notion. Prabhupada, of course, argued directly against this in a very strong way. He, when he went to Moscow and spoke to Professor Katovsky, Prabhupada pointed out, he said, well, right now in Russia, this is still into the Soviet area, you have two classes. You have the managers and the workers. So if you have two, what is the difference in principle between two and four? And you find that this is necessary. You may say in ideology you don't have it, but actually in actual practical fact. And when Mao Zedong wanted to go a little bit further, really get rid of the elitism and the class structure, and he took all the managers and all the academics and set them to work in the fields like the peasants. The result was that some 10 million people starved to death, and China has yet to recover. That was the Cultural Revolution, part of it anyway. And so it's very, very difficult to get rid of these fact that, as Prabhupada says, first class, second class, third class, fourth class, and he some places talks about tenth class too, which is the one that all of us belong to. That's all further notice. let me go on and talk a little bit more about this Varna system and how it's really related to the three modes of material nature. And I've given you a chart. At one point I gave a course on the three modes. And this chart, this is kind of a handy thing to have, because I went to all kinds of different places and showed the general nature, different characteristics, psychological type, and so on about the three modes. So it's something I compiled, and I used my computer and all that stuff. And this nice chart. Now, I guess you can't see this red writing here. This is blue. What do we have for the eraser? Is there a... This is not the eraser. Is there a thing to erase?
Actually, it's supposed to be a typer, but this is finished.
Well, there's no paper. There's supposed to be paper up here, so this is not really a board for writing on, huh? All right, I don't have a board for writing on. Well, this is... Well, there's more paper. We got to give your teachers this kind of physical support here, otherwise we have a hard time. Yeah, and I don't know this stuff. I can't even find the chalk, you know? Well, that's good. I'd much rather have be able to write on something. Is that the other one? No, it'll turn up. So we have the three modes, you know, goodness, passion, and of course ignorance. Now these are in a ranked order. Krishna clearly states in the Bhagavad Gita that the mode of goodness is better than the others. And it leads to knowledge. So the modes of nature, by the way, let's just back up a little bit. Let's begin with an empirical fact that everybody can recognize, that we see that material nature goes through cycles. Things are being created, things are being maintained, and things are being destroyed. And then the products of the destruction are reassembled, and things become created again, and then they're maintained for a while, and then again they're destroyed. This is the cycle. So when things are being created, material nature is said to be working in the mode of passion, Raja Guna. When things are being maintained, it is said to be working in the mode of goodness. And when things are being destroyed or taken apart, rotting, decaying, and so on, it's said to be in the mode of ignorance. How much I think everybody can see. Now, this becomes a fundamental category for understanding the world. If you read how creation takes place, there's the Mahatattva, then the three modes appear, and then false ego is there, and then false ego and ignorance produces some things, false ignorance and passion other things, false ignorance and goodness produces other things. So these are very fundamental categories. Now if we take our experience of the world, there's many, many different categories you can put it in for different purposes. If your purpose is to learn how to make atomic bombs, or wire a house with electricity, or manipulate electricity, these will not be of much use. Because categories or theory is always for some particular practice. And the practice Krishna has in mind is the practice of self-realization. So now you can divide the world up into many different categories for understanding and explanation. This is what Krishna gives us, the mode of goodness, mode of passion, and mode of ignorance. Because this is the way that we should try to understand material nature if our project is self-realization, which Krishna says ought to be the aim of human life. Right? So what we also find out from the Vedas is that these modes of nature also determine psychological characteristics of human beings. And so those psychological characteristics are described. As Prabhupada gives this nice capsule description, one is happy, one is active, and one is helpless. The happy, the active, and the helpless. Or the mode of consciousness. Say someone in the mode of goodness, the consciousness is very, very alert and interested, but at the same time very calm and detached and serene. Serene, but interested and alert. Whereas the mode of ignorance, serene and dull, is asleep. So this is the mode of goodness, this serene, peaceful consciousness, but yet very alert and interested. Well, the mode of passion, the person is alert and interested, but it's very narrowly focused on some particular object, money, sex, something. So this is the characteristic consciousness of the mode of passion. It produces activity. The mode of ignorance is just oblivion. You don't know what's happening. You got no idea what's going on. You're out of it. Asleep or intoxicated or crazy, but you just don't have any, you're clueless. This is the mode of ignorance. Somebody really has to show you, you know, here's the door. tell you what to do. Both of these are capable of direction. Now, and it said, Krishna says, the mode of goodness is better than the others. Now, we could say, wait a minute. What's wrong with the mode of passion? If it weren't for the mode of passion, you never would have had cities, you never would have had the tunnel under the English Channel, or whatever the channel is called on this side of the you never would. Anyway, this is in a society based on which self-realization is the ultimate goal, then goodness is going to be on the top. And passion is making its arguments, certainly. It's created a whole civil, that's the standard of advancement. We ask ourselves, what's an advanced country? And we want to see what their economic life is like. That's how we measure, as mode of passion. We don't ask, are people becoming more and more clean, austere, merciful, or truthful? We ask rather these kinds of things. Having to do with their gross domestic product, their unemployment rate, so on. And I guess you could speak up for the mode of ignorance if you can get up the couch and care enough to make a case. After one finishes procrastinating, what's wrong with the mode of ignorance? But the case has been made for the mode of ignorance also. When I was coming of age in the 60s in the United States, there was a generation gap. The parents were saying, why don't you make something of yourselves? Why don't you get out, get a job, and be productive, do something? That was the mode of passion. The younger generation says, hey, what difference does it make? You know, you can just get some marijuana and life is fine. You don't have to work so hard for everything. So the generation gap was the people, you know, speaking up for the mode of ignorance. What happened to the course of time? Half of them are dead and the other half graduated up to the mode of passion. Anyway, they're ranked like this by Krishna. The mode of goodness is better. And then from this ranking, you see, then the four varnas are described in terms of here. So you get up here, you have brahmanas. Describes them. Usually he says Brahmins in the mode of goodness, Kshatriya is the mode of passion, Vaishya is a mixture of passion and ignorance, and Shudras in ignorance. That's the way Prabhupada usually describes it, which always bothered me because it wasn't symmetrical, and everybody knows truth is symmetrical. It seemed like you had two different systems trying to fit it together. In the 11th canto of the Bhagavatam, where these are described, it's described like this. Brahmins in the mode of goodness, Kshatriyas in a mixture of goodness and passion, Vaishyas in a mixture of passion and ignorance, and Shudras in ignorance. That's much more symmetrical. I like it better. But what I think this really shows is that there's a continuum. You start off, you know, just imagine you have white and it gets a little pinkish tinge and then it gets like really, really red and then a little blue comes in until you get deep purple down here. Something like that. The colors fade into one another where white is goodness, red is passion, and blue is ignorance. Those are the traditional colors. Signs. You know how many nations have red, white, and blue in their flag? So that, you know, you get somebody purely in the mode of goodness will be a brahmana, and then gradually passion would trickle in some, and at a certain point, and I would gather that that point is actually somewhat arbitrary, you'd say this person is now a kshatriya, if you judge by the modes. Or a person somewhere in between could be trained as one or trained as the other. Notice, I mean, there are different kinds of brahmanas. There's some brahmanas who are up in the Himalayas, who never have any dealings with human society and are fully absorbed in the absolute and don't even know what century it is. There are other brahmanas like, you know, Chanakya Pandit, who are telling kings what to do. They're ministers. A very shrewd political sense, or like Dronacharya, actually on the battlefield, because they're teachers of martial arts. So you have right there within brahmanas, you already see a kind of division among kshatriyas. Well, you just look, you know, there's kshatriyas like Maharaj Yudhisthira, who's practically a brahmin, he's so non-violent. By inclination, and Bhima on the other side, who's so ferocious. So again, with kshatriyas, you have the same kind of continuum, and then Vaishyas and the same way, and then Shudra. So this is the system. The characteristics of Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas is that all three of these are characterized by the ability for independent action. Neither brahmanas nor kshatriyas or vaishyas are employees of anybody. Employee, you get a paycheck from somebody, means shudra. Now, it's the nature of modern industrial civilization to turn everybody into shudras. That's its nature. When Prabhupada, I was there when Prabhupada was came to the United States, and the reporter said to him, this was in the LaGuardia Airport, why have you come to the West? And Prabhupada said, I have come to give you a brain. He said, your civilization is headless. And he went on to explain the way we do about how the head, arms, belly, and legs of the social body, the Brahmins, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Shudras, and you need a complete body. He said, your society is a few Vaishyas, and everyone else is Shudras. That was Prabhupada's statement. And he said that other places too. Everyone is Shudra, or a few Vaishyas. Now, if you take a look at most modern countries and you actually work out who actually owns everything, you can see the truth of this. In the United States, which is a big country for equality, 5% of the families own 90% of the wealth. How did that happen? People who are, say, Vaishyas. Vaishya means you're independent. If you're a Vaishya and doing business, you're independent. So you have a little store or a business or a shop. What is the tendency of modern industrial society? You get bought up by a big conglomerate, and where before you're running own business, now you run the same business, but you get a paycheck from somebody else. You turn from Vaishya to Shudra. You lose your capacity for independent action and initiative. This is the tendency. So one thing is that we have not seen. We have not seen, we have not experienced, we haven't experienced for 5,000 years, actually, Brahmanas and Kshatriyas. Or actually Vaishyas doing what they should supposed to be doing. This is very important to remember. When you think of a Brahman, of a Kshatriya, if you think of a Kshatriya and you're thinking of, you know, General Montgomery or Patton, watch out. Because I could, the nature of modern warfare is called industrial warfare. And again, you don't usually have Kshatriyas. What you have are freaked out Shudras with guns. The tendency of modern society is to change this into the structure. Everyone a Shudra and a few Vaishyas. For all those people who like conspiracy theories, you know, here is fuel for the fire. Who are those Vaishyas? And how do they run things, you know? So we really haven't seen these qualities. As a person who spent a lot of time in academic life, where people are supposed to be Brahmanas, this is a very sad, sad story. A Brahmana means mode of goodness. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, he says, knowledge depends upon goodness. That's a very simple statement, but the implications are immense. Knowledge depends upon goodness. Goodness means sattva-guna, situated in the mode of goodness. And if to today's intellectuals and thinkers, the idea of an absolute truth, the idea of a transcendent reality, the idea of a soul, are something to which they can't relate at all, or have any understanding of, or intuition, or realization of, it is because they are not situated in the proper existential conditions for having such knowledge. In fact, the statement that there is no God, there isn't any soul, there's no transcendent truth, is just the statement of somebody whose existential condition is that of passion and ignorance and is not equipped to perceive these things. You want to see what you have to do to perceive these things? Well, you don't have to go to the Vedas, you can read Plato. He talks about it. That one has to be free from lust and greed and anger. But you go to any university where they teach philosophy or even theology for that matter, and says the preliminary requirements for this course is no eating meat, fish, or eggs, no intoxication, no illicit sex, no gambling. We're their students. So people are not really properly situated in order to have what Krishna calls knowledge. Knowledge now, again, the standard of knowledge is the mode of passion, which means knowledge how, basically, techne, knowledge of a trade, knowledge how to do something. Everybody wants to know, and before research is funded, everybody wants to know what can we bring to market as a result of this breakthrough? How can we get a product we can sell, either to the public or, of course, to the really big buyer, the military? That's what we really want to know. So we haven't really seen Brahmanas, we haven't really seen Kshatriyas, we haven't really seen properly Vaishyas. And the reason is that our experience in the West has actually been of a kind of a partial and breaking down system. This is the Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, and Sudra. Krishna says this is natural. It's made by me, but it has becomes distorted or contaminated. In India, it becomes contaminated, and it's what Prabhupada calls the Asuric Varnashram Dharma system, as opposed to the Daiva Varnashram Dharma system. The Daiva Varnashram Dharma system is the Varnashram Dharma system spoken by Deva, by Krishna. And according to that one, a person belongs to Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra by their qualities, inherent qualities, and by the work that they do. And to work, the term work, I also want to add another term, which is very important, vritti. Vritti means means of livelihood. How do you live? Part of understanding Varnashram Dharma is to understand the vital importance to this system of vritti, means of livelihood. We'll discuss this at a later point. But each one of these has its vritti. The Brahmanas, how they live. They live by donations or just by whatever comes. They take no thought of the morrow. They don't save money. Whatever they get, they give away after their needs are met. Kshatriyas live by taxation, fines, custom duties, and booty. Vaishyas by agriculture, trade, and cow protection. Shudras by being maintained by one of the other three. So this is their vritti. Duties. So that's part of their work. If you can't stand living this way without, you know, lots of life insurance, if you can't stand the financial insecurity of being a Brahmana, then maybe that's not your place in life. Anyway, so by their karma and by their work, their vritti, this is how they're to be known. Krishna says this is how you know them. Not by birth. The Asuri Varnashram Dharma is the one in which your position in these is by hereditary. And this is the, you know, hereditary Smarta Brahmana system of India. So by talking this way, Daiva Varnashram Dharma, Prabhupada really rejects the last 5,000 years of Hinduism. You should understand, just, you know, although this looks really super conservative to many people, in Indian terms, it's quite radical. And you should hear Prabhupada talk about, you know, and the whole thing began with the corruption of the Brahmanas. And Prabhupada has very, very heavy statements to make about the corrupt Brahmanas. It's the corrupt Brahmanas who instituted the system of compulsory sati, you know, where the wife had to immolate herself by force on the funeral pyre of her husband. That was the Brahmanas who did that. He actually blames the partitioning of India on the corruption of the Brahmanas. Because a person became a Brahmana who had no qualification except what family he was born in. Therefore, didn't really know what to do, didn't know how to fulfill his obligations properly. Therefore, the Sudra class became exploited and abused by the Brahmanas. When the Muslims came, it was very easy to convert those Sudras en masse into Muslims. Then you had two groups in India, Hindus and Muslims. This is a fact that the Muslims were always people who were quite dissatisfied with Vedic culture because of being exploited like crazy. And why were they exploited? Because of the corruption of the Brahmanas. Then Prabhupada said that when the British came in with their policy of divide and conquer, they made sure that the tensions between the Hindus and the Muslims were always at a high pitch. And therefore, the result was the partitioning of India into India and Pakistan. So all that partitioning, Prabhupada traces back to corrupt corruption of the Brahmanas. Prabhupada said this in lectures in India, by the way, of all places. You have to appreciate the full impact, because India feels quite wounded by this partitioning, which they like to blame on the British, but Prabhupada took it back and blamed it on the hereditary Brahmins and made more friends. So it began, according to Bhagavatam, the story is about how Sringi, the son of Shomek Rishi, became envious of Maharaj Parikshit, the Kshatriya, for a minor thing, cursed him, and this was the beginning. This is how Kali entered from the corruption of the Brahmanas. Now, I would like to give you this is a little speculative, but I wrote to it, Prabhupada about it in a letter, and he said it was all right. When I first heard, you know, started studying Varnashram Dharma, I was reminded of the social system, roughly, of medieval Europe, where you had the Brahmanas or organizes the Roman Catholic Church, which is interesting, sort of a corporate organization, which you never found in India. But anyway, but you had the Brahmanas, who were the priests, organized in the Roman Catholic Church. You had the Kshatriyas, who were the feudal lords, kings, princes, and dukes, and barons, and counts, Gotham, this and that, and so on. You had the Vaishyas, who were the rich farmers, and also the ever-rising bourgeoisie. We always hear about the rising middle class, that's the Vaishyas. And then the peasants or the serfs, who were usually bound to the land, a particular land. So yeah, it looks like this kind of a system. And then when I looked at it further, I also realized that our experience of the last 500 years of European history can be seen as the gradual collapse of this system. Now, this was never a very perfect system. And, of course, the problem was the corruption of the priesthood. This is a long story. But ultimately, just to put it very briefly, to my mind, the real problem with the church was the fact that the Bishop of Rome, otherwise known as the Pope, was also the king of a big chunk of Italy because of a forged document called the Donation of Constantine. And so the Pope was always forced to act as a Kshatriya. I mean, Popes sometimes rode to battle, and cardinals were princes. I mean, Machiavelli's prince is dedicated to Cesare Borgia, who was a cardinal, as well as the nephew, quote-unquote, of the Pope. Nephew meant son, illegitimate son. Anyway, the Brahmanas were never as pure, or only spottily as pure as they ought to have been. There were continuous reform movements which got, you know, nice. The church had this nice way of taking the Franciscans and giving them own little place that didn't disturb things too much, and so on. Anyway, at a certain point, and a great deal of history of medieval Europe is the history of this tussle between the Pope and the Holy Roman Emperor, because they were never on super good terms with each other. And, you know, anyway, there are many incidences of the snows of Canosa, where the Emperor stood barefoot begging forgiveness of the Pope and so on. At any rate, at a certain point, the Kshatriyas, in effect, rebelled against the Brahmanas. This is a broad social movement, but it's epitomized in the Protestant Reformation. And the Protestant Reformation really meant that the kings of Europe established their own churches with themselves at the head. The head of the Church of England is Queen Elizabeth II. Not a clergyman at all. And you have, you know, the churches in Germany and Sweden and so on. So that was that was really the Protestant Reformation, what it really was. Although Luther had started something as a purification movement, he seemed to have gotten taken over by German princes and utilized so they could form their own churches and thus become free from any kind of control over the Pope. Another thing was, Brahmanas, according to our Dharma, they're supposed to receive in charity, but they also give in charity. That's one of their occupational duties, is giving in charity. The church had accumulated so much land that huge tracts were off the tax rolls, and the kings became, you know, extremely envious at the wealth of the church, especially in terms of what was real wealth in those days, land. So when Henry VIII dissolved the Catholic Church in England, you know, the first thing he did was seize all this property. They took all the monks and nuns, kicked them out, made them get jobs. You know, it was a real deprogramming job of monumental proportions. And he divided all this huge amount of property among his allies. But the Brahmanas, they did not give in charity the way they're supposed to have. And I'll read you what Prabhupada said about that duty. So then you have the Kshatriyas. The Kshatriyas now, they have no brahminical control, no sanction whatsoever. So the Kshatriyas naturally become more and more outrageous and more tyrannical without the control of any kind of sanction of Brahmanas. And so they become more and more oppressive. So naturally, the Vaishyas group, the next social movement, is to revolt against the rule of the Kshatriyas. This is epitomized in the French Revolution. And the American Revolution, for that matter, or even the Glorious Revolution, which didn't work in England, that was the beginning of it. So that is a Vaishya revolution, and the result was, you know, by the end of the 19th century, the few royalty left are just figureheads, and that's the end of royalty. And of course, from this, all our idea of what a monarchy is or a king is based from literature and propaganda from this period. From this period we get statements like Diderot, you know, mankind will never be free until the last king is strangled by the intestines of the last priest, and so on. those are the, you know, so many countries are founded on statements like that. Diderot, one of the French encyclopedias. Diderot? Huh? I don't know. They know who I'm talking about anyway. So then, of course, you know, the Vaishyas get themselves real organized as the capitalist class. So, of course, the next thing is the Shudras, having been oppressed and so forth, have their own uprising, which is the socialist and communist revolutions. And there you have it, the collapse. It's always been going on. But generally, as I say, they're epitomized in these different sorts of revolutions. Now, you notice, this has been the social dynamic of the last 500 years up until maybe 10 years ago. And finally, the Shudra thing has pretty much collapsed. I mean, you may notice that now that the Soviet Union is gone, it has become harder for workers everywhere in the world. It's very interesting, you know, like in the United States, labor unions are very weak. They can't hold the line on wages anymore. Capital feels free to export factory jobs to third world countries where there isn't any organized labor and people will work for anything. It's amazing what's going on now. Because I think what you're seeing is a reassurance. It seems to be going back the other way. Now you have a big Vaishya class that's now feels quite free to do anything they like. And you're getting the concentration of wealth into fewer and fewer hands. I have some idea of where it'll go from here, but that would be speculating too much about the future. It's bad enough to speculate about the past. But anyway, so this is our whole history in Europe for the last 500 years has been basically a kind of collapse of these sorts of positions, and always envy, oppression, warfare. This is what's been going on. So if we measure our idea of what a Vaishya is, or a Kshatriya, or a Brahmana, or a Shudra, any of these things, from our own social experience or the social experience of our heritage, it's quite defective. So we have to be ready to start over. We're trying to get a clean slate on the whole thing and look at the whole system all over again without our ideas and expectations. Last point I want to make today about understanding Varnashram Dharma, it also doesn't, two last points, it doesn't make real sense, this system, unless you understand that your basic vritti of the whole society, your basic economy, is agrarian. Industrial economy, Varnashram Dharma does not make sense. If you start to imagine an agrarian economy, then Varnashram Dharma more and more works. And it is Prabhupada's opinion that an industrial economy is artificial, it's distorted, it's contrary to the purposes of human life. Soul-killing factories, he called them. Modern soul-killing factories. And we are living in an industrial economy, even though right now the tendency is the more brutal factory jobs are now being exported to India and Malaysia and places like that. All that's happened in the West is because of computers. Ordinary office work is being changed into factory work, where, you know, the jobs are broken into discrete parts and everybody does a little piece of it, and you're always supervised at every minute. So it's really hyper-industrialization we're going through in the modern days, even though, like in the United States, it's supposed to be an information and service economy rather than an industrial economy. It's that these things are also done in the same way as factory labor. So anyway, this is, according to Prabhupada, this industrial civilization is, well, you, all the devotees, you know, you can't eat nuts and bolts, it's not natural. If the Vaishyas, the thing about cow protection, if the Vaishyas actually protect cows, just as the Kshatriyas are supposed to protect the citizens, and the Brahmins are supposed to protect everybody, all living beings, and the Vaishyas protect the cows, the economic result of cow protection is you will have to have an agrarian society. It just follows immediately, because you cannot have cow protection viable unless you plow with the bulls. You will not be able to plow with bulls. If you plow with bulls or oxen, you got to have it's labor intensive. Everybody's got to move out of the cities and back to the farms. You're going to have an agrarian economy, and agrarian economy means several things. Children become an economic asset in an industrial economy. Children are an economic liability. They're only here for sentimental purposes, purposes of human affection, but they are not. One devotee once told me, he said to me, cow protection is a very expensive hobby. If that's true, if you want to protect cows under our present conditions, you have to subsidize it like crazy. And Prabhupada knew it would never work unless they were economically productive. Then it occurred to me, in an industrial economy, children are also a very expensive hobby. In an agrarian economy, children immediately become economic productive from the age of six. And that's why everybody likes to have big families. Because, you know, you have imagine a family farm or a family firm. Children are one more worker. Everybody loves big families. And we can't afford not to have children. What do you do in an industrial economy? How many children can we afford to have? Each one, in at least the United States, costs $350,000 to raise to the age of 18. We're not talking about college tuition. That's a very expensive hobby. Now, what's the return on your investment? So those are reasons to understand that to imagine Varnashram Dharma, you also have to imagine an agrarian economy. You have to imagine village life. You have to imagine a society where people are rooted. Because another thing Varnashram Dharma teaches us is not only the proper way to be detached, but also the proper way to be attached. That's why there's pravritti and nirvritti mark. And there is a right way to be attached. And those of us that are attached should at least learn the right way to be attached. And that's also part of Varnashram Dharma. And then another last point that we're going to talk about is in Varnashram Dharma, or even a hierarchical society, we have an ethic of obligations. In modern society, we have a social ethic of rights. Everybody wants rights. But actually, and you will not find in the pages of Prabhupada practically anywhere rights mentioned. But what are mentioned and mentioned all over the place are obligations. The obligations of a brahmana, duties, responsibilities of a brahmana, the obligations of a kshatriya. It doesn't say anything about anybody's rights, but a kshatriya has failed. If anyone, then the kingdom is hungry. If anyone is unemployed, the government has failed. So when there's an obligation, that means, you know, it's the obverse side of a right. But the discussion is not about rights. The discussion is about obligations. When people no longer know when their obligations are or fulfill them, then there's discussion about rights. So rights is a discussion of social decay. So we have to start talking about obligations. When you start looking to this in terms of what people's obligations or responsibilities are, then the system starts to look a whole lot different. And when you give those obligations as much importance as we nowadays give to rights, and you'll find out that people have a whole lot more rights under this system than they ever have had in a democracy. So that's another thing we're going to discuss in this course. And I think when we put it all together and try to imagine ourselves in the situation, what Prabhupada was talking about will make a lot more sense. Whether we're going to get there from here or how, that's another question. But at least we should understand what the system is that he's talking about. It's 7 o'clock now, and Aarti's beginning. I didn't mean quite to not leave any more time. If those who want to go can go, and I'll stay and answer some questions if there are any questions at this point. Yeah.
I have a question, but before I want to explain how I take this question. You mentioned that Prabhupada said, lower cannot be created, we have to follow.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, you described how the revolution against the upper corrupt class. So I was thinking, was it right or was it wrong to make this revolution that I suggested to myself it was
natural? Yeah.
So, but my question is, what is the right way? What to do with corrupt or incompetent
security? Yeah, that's a very good question. When the system starts to decay or when people don't fulfill their obligations, then there are certain ways to deal with it. In a hierarchical society, things get a little tricky, the best way to deal with it. Certainly you can understand this as a reaction. But on the other hand, you might have to say that there may be a genuine problem with corruption. But when people seek to fix it, a lot of times what they create is even worse. Capitalism may be oppressive and horrible, but communism turns out to be even worse. So you have to know what to do. And it's true. Actually, there's somebody to correct everything, and ultimately it depends upon the brahmanas. And if the brahmanas aren't doing their duty, well, among the brahmanas there's others, there's subdivisions, and there's the sannyasis among the brahmanas. And ultimately, if everybody is corrupt, I really can't tell you what you do at that point. You know, people have their natural way of dealing with things. People also have a right, like the Kshatriya was supposed to sit, and anybody who had a complaint was supposed to be able to come. They had their obligations. If they weren't fulfilling their obligations, then the Brahmas were there to rectify them. If the Brahmanas weren't doing it right, that's your court of last resort, as far as I can see. What to do? Then you're going to get social disorder. As you say, it's understandable. But at that point, almost everything you're going to do is wrong, unless you actually know how to restart the whole thing by having actual brahmanas, which is what Prabhupada is trying to do. Yeah.
My idea is the only way to go out of this, if you have corrupt superiors,
mm-hmm.
is to try to become independent by becoming Krishna conscious.
Well, you can do that, but you know, when Prabhupada dealt with this problem. In one time in New York City, the president of New York City became corrupt and fallen. And when it finally was exposed, Prabhupada had a couple of reactions. One, he was happy that the devotees, even though the president was corrupt and fallen, and sometimes quite cruel and exploitive of everybody, but he was happy that the devotees still kept to their service so that the Krishna consciousness movement could go on. That was one thing. He was also distressed that it took devotees so long to recognize that this person was corrupt. They thought that just because he was the superior, everything he did was right, when it was obviously against principles of Krishna consciousness were being broken, including stories of, clams or fish being offered to the deities and stuff like that. Prabhupada told the devotees that they should use their intelligence and that they should not surrender their intelligence. Of course, at that point, you know, it meant that they had recourse, that it was quite legitimate to go and complained to Prabhupada, which was finally done. And finally the situation was rectified. But he said that one should not surrender one's intelligence. Actually, it's by means of your buddhi, your intelligence, that you surrender. So if you surrender your intelligence, then you become a zombie. So we know what is right and wrong, and so we have a right to that view. But then particularly how you regress it. If things get bad enough, I guess you can back off. We do see in the Bhagavatam sometimes people out of disgust, like Vidura, he went on pilgrimage. So that's, as you said, that's one recourse. But Prabhupada was happy that the devotees stayed in spite of everything just to keep the preaching of Krishna consciousness going on. And eventually it was rectified. That's a long topic, actually, that you mentioned. Yes.
I wanted to say that Srila Prabhupada wanted us to establish Vanashram Dharma in a more or less longer time. But actually you are explaining that it's possible only when when these factories that produce the technology both on us will be finished. So does it mean we have to wait for this time?
In my judgment, there are things we can do now, but you really won't get a fully articulated system, as far as I can see, unless you have an agrarian economy. Kshatriyas operate by chivalry. In an industrial economy, a warfare under industrial economy, chivalry is stupid. It's counterproductive. It doesn't make any sense. The last time anybody tried to have chivalry in war was the First World War. But that was put to death by machine guns, actually. That's what they're called, machine guns. You know, You know, at a certain point, prowess doesn't make any difference. And that's why you know, you just give somebody 3 weeks training and put a piece of firepower into his hand, manufactured, and brrr, and send them out to slaughter each other. That's what you do. Chivalry doesn't make any sense. So it seemed to me that Prabhupada believed that sooner or later the industrial economy, being unnatural, was going to collapse. Some people are expecting this any minute. I personally tend to think that an economy, even in a natural one, has got an awful lot of collapse in it. And it may take it can be collapsing for several hundred years. To us it looks very slow, and from a historical standpoint it'd be quite fast. But to us it might look like slow motion. But at least this much, establishing the Brahmanas, Prabhupada wanted to do right away. And I would suggest that we start with this part especially. Well, actually, the two places Prabhupada wanted seemed to begin was Brahmanas and Vaishyas. At least some places where we could practice this kind of rule economy and learn how to do it to be locally self-sufficient. That to get devotees or anybody to do it en masse, I think will only happen until people are forced to. My frustration being the GBC of a farm project is that very few devotees actually want to slow down from 60 miles an hour to 5. It's just there's a reason why people don't like farm life. It's slow and the work is hard. But anyway, this is a big, but anyway, Prabhupada did want this, he established these communities so that at least some practical knowledge of how to do this would be available when the time come. But Brahmanas, he really wanted to get together. And I thought, well, you know, if we ever actually get the Brahmanas established, then the Brahmanas can actually figure the rest of it out. How to do it. But we haven't really done anything like what Prabhupada would want for us to establish people as Brahmanas. That means, to me, our first goal is that all of ISKCON has to be kind of refashioned into a educational institution. When we do that, then when we sit down, we'll have the proper people to get together and figure out the rest of this system. But we haven't done that yet with ISKCON. So if we get, Krishna always lets you know the next step. He doesn't maybe let you know all the steps, but he always lets you know the next step. And I know this is the next step. There's no question about it.
If one becomes a pure devotee, one is automatically a brahmana.
Yes, that's right.